Welcome to Meaningful Play, the podcast where we discuss our favourite medium, video games, and the cultural and social issues that surround them. If you'd like to support our podcast, you can support us through Buy Me a Coffee. If you go to meaningfulplaypodcast.wordpress.com, you can find the link there. Thanks. Hi guys, and welcome to episode 20 on environmental storytelling. Today we've got a special guest joining us to have this chat, and her name's Heather, and I'll just ask Heather to briefly introduce herself.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, guys. It's very nice to be here. I started doing research at EWA this year, also in video games, and I'm doing a project that looks at aesthetic analysis of games and how and why we make particular like value judgments about games, and I'm doing quite an in-depth study of the work of Supergiant Games, who best known now for Hades, but have four really interesting independent games. And then prior to this, I was a communications advisor and I lived in London for a while doing that. Yeah, but thanks for having me.
Thank you. I think you're going to add so much to our conversation.
I think Thank you. Exciting having you here.
Thank you. Particularly
in terms of like aesthetics, because that's something that Sean and I don't really research.
Yeah, like we're interested in it, but don't really have that stronger background.
Oh, you guys are going to make me blush.
So, I guess we'll start just as usual with what we've been playing lately. For me, I have been very minimal in my variety of games lately. I've been still playing Phasmophobia, which has been the best, and I highly recommend people play. Because you can drop in for like a quick game for 15, 20 minutes, get scared, go, okay, that was great, and then move on. You know, like you don't need a lot of time.
I feel like that needs to be my Christmas game. Maybe. Yeah. Like, it's
honestly not too scary. So, yeah, I've been trying to convince these guys to get it. It's not too scary because you're playing with friends and you're talking and planning and you're investigating. So, like, look, you will get scared. And I'm also a screamer. Like, I shriek a lot if the phone rings. You know, like, so it's kind of definition of scary is a bit different. But, yeah, it's I think it's very manageable levels of scary. Like, it's okay. Otherwise, I've been playing Animal Crossing and the big update came out, which when Heather messaged me saying, did you know it came out early? And I was like, ah! As usual, I've been playing a bit of that. But otherwise, I'm basically a complete Final Fantasy 14 addict now, and I have a huge problem. Like, every summer, I usually play an MMO, like, just as my end-of-year present to myself. And, yeah, with, I mean, WoW, I will always have a place in my heart because first solid MMO, really enjoyed it, but as we all know, Blizzard's being a bit shit, to put it mildly. But not even just that. Like, in terms of the game itself, I was getting to a point where it felt really grindy and it kind of, people just weren't that nice. And it was getting a bit repetitive. And I'd log in at my once a year present to myself and go, what the hell is all this stuff in my inventory? And I would just be lost. I had a go at Final Fantasy XIV, which I've tried before. And it turns out I, like, made a character in the most hard-to-navigate city and I kind of got overwhelmed and then stopped. But now I'm a complete addict. I just feel like it's so engaging. The people are so nice. I'm really fascinated to understand why people are so friendly in this game compared to other MMOs. It's just the environments are beautiful and there are less zones than in WoW, but you don't get bored because, like, for all the different levels of characters, there's always something for you to do in a given zone. It's very clever design. It'd be very fascinating, I think, to compare them both. But to be honest, like, I'm just a total addict. Like, you can do glamours. At level 10, you can do glamours, so you can make a character look cute. I downloaded an add-on that puts filters on my gameplay so I can look cute and take glamour shots all the time. And for some reason, I'm just doing that all the time. I love it. I think it's just such a well-balanced MMO and it's, I just want to play it all the time.
I think it's nice that you feel that way about it. And it's something that I see online a lot now. Because I remember when it first came out, so there was a lot of criticisms surrounding it. But it seems like over time it's become like one of the best, if not the best current MMO.
Yeah, what happened was I heard that what happened was the game got released and it was a terrible, apparently. Like, it was not good and broken and da-da-da. So then they actually rehashed it, and that's why it's called A Realm Reborn, because the original game they kind of threw away. So, I guess it'd be interesting to look at that too as a way of saying, okay, we don't want it to flop, it did flop, let's figure out what's wrong and reinvent it and be wildly successful after that. It's quite interesting.
I must say, I do look at the character aesthetic. I saw that they had a Nier Automata.
Yeah, so that's a raid, and I'm apparently quite far away from doing it, but it's my goal. Like, it's that's what goal, I'm aiming okay. for. It's like, yeah. Yeah, there's, like, apparently Nier Automata raids with the soundtrack, and you can get the outfits, which I'm a Lalafell, so I'm basically a cute hobbit.
Oh,
because
cute.
All the others were kind of sexualized, and I was like, But, yeah, so the thought of a Lalafell in a Nier Automata outfit's a bit weird, but I'm super keen. I really want to get there. And it's just, yeah, every step has been enjoyable, and I tried a healer for the first time ever yesterday, and I said in the dungeon, like, if this is literally my first time being a healer, please tell me if I'm doing something wrong. And they're like, that's fine, don't worry about it. Gave me some tips, and I got commendations at the end, and I was like, oh, that's such a positive experience. Whereas the last few times I played WoW, people have just been mean. Like, it's sort of like you have to be an expert, you're treated kind of crap if you're not an expert. And I think there's just a lot of people in there who've been playing for a long time, and the expectation is that everybody else is the same, and it's just not as welcoming.
I feel like that's something that sometimes puts me off going back to an older MMO, or one that's been out for a while, is that in some places it can feel like you have to already be good to actually even start playing.
And if you already have, like, a high-level character and you haven't played in a while, or high-level, you know, like, higher, and then you come back and you're like, people think I know what I'm doing, but I'm actually lost because so much has changed in that time. Like,
but it actually doesn't help the longevity of these MMO worlds if people feel like they need to be particularly good from the get-go.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So, and what have you guys been playing?
So, as I always preface to what I've been playing recently, I haven't had a lot of time recently. So, I'm only going to talk about one game today, a nice little, like, two-hour stint in the Japanese horror world. I played Convenience Store by a Japanese indie developer, premise in which is you play as a young woman employed as a night shift employee at a Japanese convenience store.
Oh, like Lawson's.
Like Lawson's, yes. So the narrative of the title spans over your shift over 4 nights. And over those 4 nights, you are exposed to pretty terrifying paranormal activity. I thought that this game was fantastic, particularly as it's only the cost of a coffee. And I never actually thought that any kind of media could make me really fear a convenience store, but this successfully did so. Because you know when you go to the convenience store, you're going for, like, something yummy. You know,
and it's always, like, super brightly lit and colourful or whatever, music
exactly,
playing.
Exactly, yeah. But this is, like, it feels like a liminal space where you feel really isolated. You have a stalker as well.
Ooh.
And you have to actually complete tasks while you're working. And one of those tasks is to continually go to the back of the convenience store, and you receive videotapes from your stalker throughout the game, and you know that they're watching you,
so
and
Japanese.
it's the tension of it. It's like, oh, I've got to do a task at the back of the store, and I got that videotape yesterday, and I know that they're potentially there watching me. Okay, don't want to go into spoiler territory there, but the game just creates this really just spooky atmosphere.
That sounds awesome.
It was awesome. Actually, there's one particular standout for me within this game is the fact that you always start off in your apartment every day and you have to walk to the store at night. So you're not actually driving to the store. There's no flip between, you know, your apartment to the store, not like a cutscene where it's like loading and you're at the convenience store. No, you have to walk through your, what I assume is a rural Japanese town, but I could be incorrect. But you have to walk through it at night to get to the convenience store, and every night it gets darker and darker.
Oh.
Again, you are receiving videotapes from your stalker. And so just walking through that with, like, barely any light, you have a flashlight, sometimes you take your umbrella because it's raining, and it the whole time I was just so uncomfortable.
It sounds interesting, like, not only as, like, the horror theme, but the idea that I assume you're a female character.
Yes.
Like, you've got a stalker. Mm-hmm. You're having to go into these situations where you, like, we would all probably feel unsafe walking at night in
So
like it's quite interesting in that sense as well, I guess. It's,
yeah. And there's nobody else in the rural Japanese town. It's midnight. And so you are completely alone. And so you really feel like that fear of the unknown, or feeling like somebody's watching you, really internalize while you're playing. You're just like, oh, let me just run to the convenience store. And when you see the convenience store, because it is neon and lit, and you just, oh, a safe place. But no, it's the liminal space evil convenience store where, you know, paranormal activity is occurring and you're being haunted. Wanted there, like the whole game never makes you quite feel safe. I mean, even in your apartment, that's where you watch the videotapes, and so it has that evil videotape vibe as well. Yeah. So you never feel, safe in this game. And there's so few interactions you have with actual people as well. Like every time you go to the convenience store, for example, there's the employee that's working the prior shift and you're taking over from them. But even then, they're friendly, but there's something a bit off about them as well. And even the customers that come in, I think it's because of the aesthetics of the game as well. You know that kind of horror aesthetic at the moment where the faces kind of seem just pasted on? Do you know what I mean? Where it's like their face is like completely flat. There's not really any like sort of like a detail to them. Like
that uncanny valley.
Yes, it's definitely that. And so, the game is just quite uncomfortable. I'm not sure how I feel about the endings. I thought that the endings were a bit rushed, a little disappointing. The good ending, for example, you simply get a block of text that's acting as like the protagonist's diary, talking about what happened after the climax at the convenience store, the narrative's climax. And I'll be like, oh, but I really want to go back to the convenience store. This character probably doesn't want to, so I understand that this isn't this is more of a personal criticism. But I would really have loved to have gone back to the convenience store afterwards, particularly given what we learn about the convenience store and where it's located. I thought it was a fantastic game, particularly if you only have a few hours to spare. Really great horror experience. And Chiller, the developer, has so many little experiences like this set in different Japanese settings.
They are a Japanese developer?
Yes.
But like the thing that came to mind as soon as I saw you want to talk about it. Have you read Convenience Store Woman by Sayaka
Murata? I have, yes.
And I was oh my gosh, like, because that's sort of scary in a different way at it times is. Because she's quite an odd character, which I really enjoyed. I love that book. I wonder if there's any kind of like overlap in the inspiration between.
I wonder this as game well, because there's definitely, like Sean was saying before, there's definitely this premise that's built on the fact that you are a female working at night at this store is quite unusual, and the kind of justification for that is you need the money. So capitalism is brought into it as well. So I guess you could kind of see the fact that somebody is forced into this. Maybe they're not so abnormal, but the fact that she continues to go to the convenience store night after night, even though it's haunted, makes me think that this character really is a little strange. But at the same time, everything in this game is a little strange. So, it's fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
I'm super keen. I'm going to look this up. Right.
Yeah, me too.
Heather, what have you been playing?
I've been very slowly, for similar time reasons, replaying Mass Effect Andromeda, which came out in 2017. It's been around for a while. The Mass Effect trilogy is my favorite, set of games. And I was really keen to replay the remastered version, but it's quite an emotional investment to me to replay that. So I ended up picking up Mass Effect Andromeda again, which I really liked in 2017. And I am really enjoying it, playing it again now. When it launched, it obviously had a bit of a publicity.
This is the one with the drama about the endings, right? Or is that a different one?
Mass Effect
3. Oh, my bad. Okay.
I was just going to say it was something to do with the game seeming unfinished in some way, or at least been a bit glitchy, buggy.
Yeah. Right? For Mass Effect Andromeda, it's an interesting one because it's one of those things where certain games tend to cop publicity for similar issues that other games
don't.
Classic example is Bethesda, who will happily release a game that's buggy and that's kind of a quirky sort of, it's kind of their brand to do that. And I think, they tend not to cop much flack, or even just re-releasing the same buggy game.
Yeah.
How many times? What number are we
and
up
the community
to now?
Does the fixes and stuff. Yeah. That's expected, kind of.
And I think because Mass Effect is such a big, emotional game that's huge franchise and has so many people invested in it. And it did, like, the ending of Mass Effect 3, they did an extended cut version after because people weren't happy with the ending. Mostly, I think, because people were so deeply invested in the characters, they didn't feel like the ending had been justified enough. I was quite lucky because I didn't even play Mass Effect 3 until after the extended cut came out, so I didn't really... I kind of missed whatever that original ending was. It wasn't something that I played. But then obviously Andromeda also came out not that long after Dragon Age Inquisition was released, which was like a big critical success. And in many ways, Andromeda is built on the same engine as Inquisition. Okay. So technically, and in its design and its sort of layout, it's actually more of a successor to a Dragon Age game than it is to the original trilogy, which is... The original trilogy is great. It's very linear in terms of its level design. There's a very sort of set narrative that you pursue, whereas Andromeda is more of an open world. You know, in Inquisition you have these big open regions which you can kind of wander around and discover things. That's a lot more like what Andromeda is. And I think a lot of the problems, not problems, but the things in Inquisition that felt a bit rough, like Skyhold to me always felt a bit empty, like not much was... happening, and in Andromeda, they really, I think they really worked to rectify that. And like your ship is very busy, and the characters on it move around a lot, and they're always kind of having banter with each other, and it's quite a vibrant world in that respect. But I think a lot of the publicity was around people didn't like the graphics, in particular the graphics of how the women looked in the game. I remember that being a sticking point. Although it was a while ago now. But I'm always kind of, if a game gets odd publicity, it kind of makes me want to play it more. Maybe that's just because I like going against the grain. If everyone's being like, oh, this is rubbish, I'm like, okay, well, is it? And why? But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think it's very playable. Like, the gameplay is great. It's better than the original trilogy in that, you know, it's very quick, it's very snappy. It's really beautifully designed. It has, the other thing that's really different about it compared to the original trilogy is that the original trilogy, you start out as this like military hero, whereas Andromeda is very much like a Bildungsroman, like coming of age narrative where you are a very young, very kind of naive character at the start of the game. And the other big difference, which I didn't really notice the first time I played, or I didn't pay as much attention to it, but I think having worked in like corporate jobs since I originally played it, is that the Andromeda Initiative is a corporate initiative. It's not military or like government driven. It was founded by a billionaire called Jian Garsen. And you're at the beginning of the game, at least, you're kind of only really there because your dad is part of this mission. Like, your personal investment is actually quite low outside of that. It's kind of like, oh, my dad made me go. Like, that's kind of the... how it starts. And obviously that changes as you play through the game. The story starts to unravel. But I think playing it again, especially now where we have organizations like SpaceX and Blue Origin who are kind of superseding state-run space initiatives like NASA, or, you know, NASA's working with SpaceX on different shuttles. It's kind of an interesting lens to look at that. And I wonder if some of the jarringness that people felt when they first played Andromeda were because it's very different. Like, Shepard is, in the original trilogy, very, like, military hero, quite, like, binary, kind of, like, moral codes, whereas the Andromeda Initiative is quite different in terms of how it sets itself out to be. And they're quite playful with that setting, which I didn't really... I think I was aware of it, but I didn't really, like, spend a lot of time thinking about it the first time I played, in the sense that, like, there's almost that kind of corporate gaslighting going on when you first get to Andromeda, the new galaxy. That's kind of where the game sets out. So the Andromeda Initiative leaves the Milky Way to travel to the Andromeda galaxy. And, yeah, when you get there, things have very much gone to shit. Like, civilly, environmentally, there's a lot of stuff that hasn't really panned out as it should have done. But all the, like, sort of info screens and the different hubs and space areas will be like, welcome to this great place that we founded. And there's loads of, like, hollows of Jian Garsen, who founded the initiative. And as soon as you get to the main space station, which was where the sort of, like, forward forward arm of the initiative, who got there first, you find out that Gian Garson died immediately upon arrival.
Oh, that's juicy.
And, none of the sort of like colonization efforts to build people home have worked out. You've had political unrest, so people have, there's been infighting and people have just left the Nexus and sort of formed their own factions, but the actual like branding of the initiative hasn't been updated when you get there, so you sort of get there and try and figure out what's going on.
That sounds really like a good way to suck you into the game, and to have that disconnect.
It's really fun, and you know, you can, because you're essentially a worker when you get here. You're not a space hero, really. You're an employee of the Andromeda Initiative, and you can ask the info screen, how many days leave do I have? And it will say, you've got, you know, 480 days until your next, like, annual leave. And over the speakers and the main space station, there's, like, constant reminders that, you know, overtime hours remain in effect, because obviously they've lost people, they've had people leave by choice. In all the offices of the different managers of the initiative, there's just, like, constant phone calls coming in, and I was like, oh, this feels like my old office, like
stress and juicy,
like working in a communications job. And I think it definitely is not a sequel to the trilogy. It's very much a standalone game that exists in the same IP.
This sounds like a capitalist nightmare.
Which is quite popular lately, right?
It is.
Like, I think, I have two games, and I keep getting mixed up between things that have very similar names. Mm. It's like Outer Wilds and Outer...
Worlds.
Yes. And I haven't... Outer Worlds, I watched Harris play because I had a go, but the text was too small. And he's kind of reviewed... Yeah, has that kind of tone where it's all a bit... slightly sarcastic with this great capitalist.
I love Outer Worlds. Yeah. I really enjoyed that game. I don't think I finished it from memory, but it's, I think that, like, corporate gaslighting is kind of the word for it, where all the sort of marketing says it's one thing, and of course it's so obviously not. That's a good game. It's a funny one, though, because unlike those games where you kind of enter into it with that kind of irony, like, oh, this is a little bit funny, like, this is clearly wrong. In Andromeda, you're part of that initiative, so it's not so much framed as it's morally one way or the other. It's just all that there is. Like, all that is left is this corporate or civilian initiative, which some of the characters will call it. They say, we're not military, we're civilian.
Interesting.
Which I just think of, you know, Elon Musk going to space and talking about how great his civilian initiative is. And it's, you know, it's an interesting game in that it just kind of plonks you in it instead of setting it up to be bad or funny or ironic or anything like that.
And then maybe it helps you understand a bit more people who are in that position in real life, where it's like, because we very easily say, oh, how dumb, how could you work for someone like that, or it's so obvious, but maybe by giving the experience like that, you can kind of get a bit of a better understanding of why it's, they can still be critical of it, but have to function within that system to survive. Like, that, for them, that's their only choice.
I think so. And that's literally the premise of the game, is that you have to make this work because you can't go back.
Yeah.
You've come so far that it was always a one-way mission to this new galaxy. So whatever is left here, you can't go back. And that's kind of what your character is left with. And that's how the rest of the narrative is framed, and it's very much like a family trauma type. All the characters have some kind of altercation between their family legacy and their identity, which again, so different to the trilogy. It wasn't so much a focus in those games, whereas it's a lot more like of a personal story, and your character especially has a lot of the sort of sub narratives of the game are discovered by basically unpicking things that have been secrets in your own family's history that relate to why you're there in the first place. And so I've been very, very gradually replaying that, but I really enjoyed it. I think if I get the time, it's always nice to go back to some of those games and replay them, because I think you pick up things that maybe you didn't notice on your first playthrough. I think if you're analyzing like a book or a film, you'll probably watch it a few times, but with games, because the time commitment is so different, you don't always
absolutely
get a chance to do that, which is why, you know, 2-hour games are so great for thinking yes about what it's doing and the mechanics behind it, because it's easy to come back and replay it and think about it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds fascinating. I think this is the first time I'm actually interested in playing Andromeda. Only because I haven't really read any criticism about it because, you know, I'm funny about the spoilers, but also because of that publicity. I'm just like, oh, you know, I've tried to play Mass Effect before, I couldn't get into it, but this is like, okay, this is a bit more of my style, a coming-of-age story, hyper-capitalism in space, and this feeling of being stuck in a system that is a literal nightmare, family trauma, like, it sounds fantastic, so thank you for sharing.
No worries.
I'm curious.
Glad I could sell it. I think I saw someone write something recently, and I saw this on Twitter, and it was an article, and someone was like, Andromeda, like, is it actually a good game? And I think that publicity cycle for some people means that they won't, obviously, because they'll read it and be like, oh, that's not for me. It means they might not pick up the game. But a lot of the time, those articles are coming out before people have actually sat with the game.
There's a lot
thought
of that,
about it,
hey,
for a while. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I don't think they land everything perfectly in Andromeda. I really don't. Like, and that's a very BioWare thing to do, where they have quite a good thing or a good story, and sometimes it's difficult to make every aspect of it work perfectly. And there are parts of Dragon Age Inquisition that I felt like that about, even though it is a game I really enjoyed. Yeah, but I think it's probably a good game to actually enter playing Mass Effect.
Cool.
Maybe even more so than the first Mass Effect game, because that game is very old.
I tried to play the first game, because this is like Harris's favourite series of all time. So I tried to play the first one, but frankly I got so frustrated trying to find my way around the ship that I literally just gave up. Because apparently I have no patience or navigational skills. But I guess it sounds like really flippant to say that's what made me stop, but I think it didn't suck me in necessarily enough. And I think I'm very turned off by the military theme. I think any time a game has a super military theme, I'm like, nah, not my thing. And I'm going to hate my character, and I'm going to hate what people say. And it kind of puts me off. But I think, yeah, maybe if Andromeda is like an introduction to that world, then I appreciate it a bit more, understand it a bit more than maybe the more military theme, I can be a bit more empathetic towards.
Yeah. And when I was thinking about this, because in Mass Effect 2, you actually work for a non-military organization for a while, but it's framed as very morally questionable the whole time. Like, it's very much positioned as not necessarily the right choice, but the choice that works to get something done at the time. And by the end of the series, that organization is very firmly, like, bad, whereas I think Andromeda is a little more creative about how it thinks about that and is a bit more experimental with the setting. It's a bit less binary in terms of what's good and what's bad, at least in that respect. Other parts of the games, maybe not so much, but yeah.
Awesome. Now we'll move on to environmental storytelling. So I thought first we might start with some examples that come to mind when we think of environmental storytelling before, like, getting down into the nitty-gritty of what that means. So my example is Life is Strange. What I found really interesting about it is that, aside from the characters, sometimes the dialogue is kind of hilariously daggy, and it's totally not how people speak. But I found the world itself to be quite believable. Like, Chloe, the rooms are like teenagers' rooms, they're what I expect. Their households are like that. There's some tension with the parents and the step-parent. The school, in many ways, is quite believable in terms of how I remember school to be in that sense. But there was one particular moment that I found really stuck out to me, and that was, spoilers, when you're exploring different results of decisions, and one of the universes you explore is one where Chloe is quite ill and she's handicapped. And it was so powerful because after spending so much time in a game where you know what their house looks like, you know what their room looks like, their personality, their family, you have a really strong idea about what all these things are, suddenly it's totally different because of her illness, because she's unwell. And it was quite shocking because firstly, like, her bedroom is upstairs normally, but now she can no longer go upstairs. So the garage is now her bedroom. And it's straight away that change where normally that's where you would hang out. Now, no, it's completely different. And it's the bed is a special bed for movement. Like, all the medical equipment is there. The way that they have to, her parents have to constantly be monitoring her, I guess, and making sure that she's okay and thinking about how she's going to get to different appointments and things. And I watched a video from the makers of Life is Strange, and they were talking about how they did lots of research into medical equipment for people with illnesses and the lives of people with illnesses to see, like, what did you find difficult and how did you feel? And they actually specifically spoke to doctors for insight into degenerative disease in particular. And they also did research into things like medical expenses because, again, it's about that real... I use my air quotes here, that real world experience of this is the family unit, these are their real life struggles, this is what normal people go through when these kinds of things happen. And I think, yeah, there were all these, when I say environmental storytelling, it's for me, it was very much what this room looked like. It was so different. And Life is Strange is obviously a lot of you are looking around and picking up things and looking at them. That's part of the gameplay. So you're encouraged to engage in the environment in that way. And it's standing out so differently compared to the environment that you were used to for the majority of the game also made it extra, extra powerful, I think. So yeah, that's the first example that came to my mind.
I must say, I've always found, Chloe's bedroom in the alternative universe quite impactful. You can definitely tell that there was a lot of effort put into how the room was constructed and how you as... I've forgotten her name. Your player character. I've totally forgotten her name.
Oh my god, I've gone blank as well.
Have you played Life is Strange?
Max.
Max.
For some reason, Ellie is in my head, and I'm like, no. Yeah.
I was like trying to go through all those. I don't want to call them hipster girl names. Yeah. I'm just like, wait a minute. I'll just cycle through them. Yeah. So when you're playing as Max and you're interacting in that space, it really does kind of forge this really empathetic connection between you as the player character and with Chloe as the kind of your best friend or, you know, the kind of object of your affections. It's just very, a highly emotive space. And I really like that they placed that in there because I think it transformed the game from, you know, just a really cute little teenage romp, you know, time travel story to something that was a little more serious and was willing to actually tackle some really significant social themes.
Mm. So, yeah, what examples came to your mind?
I had a few that popped up, and I think I've been watching the Foundation TV series Apple TV, so I've been very much in that, like, high science fiction mood, and I was a game I love the world building of. I haven't played it in a really long time, but I love the world building of Destiny because it's just so like high science fiction, high fantasy. Like, it's huge. I think to actually like understand everything that they're trying to get out, you need to read the books. You need to, a lot of the story is in just like item descriptions. But I think they do a really good job. I think that classic science fiction world we see a little bit less of now. A lot of it's very dystopian, very kind of, there's a lot of grittiness and darkness, and I love how like colorful and vibrant the world of Destiny is. There's a really good mission in Destiny 2. It's called Utopia, and one of the places you go early on is Titan, which is one of Saturn's moons, and basically most of the level is this city called New Pacific Arcology that has been very long abandoned and is kind of sinking into the ocean, and I think you can really feel like the Bioshock influence and a little bit of fallout in terms of that almost like Americana type setting. And of course the mission sends you right to the bottom of this place as you do, and the further down you go, you know, the spaces get sort of narrower and darker, and there's of course aliens in there called the Hive, and they have quite like zombie-like mechanics, so it's kind of alluding to that horror genre where you only have your little headlight. And then you get all the way down to the bottom, and you're recovering this old bit of technology from, it's the golden age of humanity. It's this era that I think happened like 500 years before you actually get there, and you come out to this, you go through all these really dark tunnels, and then it opens out into this big sort of space with lots of like glass paneling around. Have you guys ever seen The Meg?
No.
Great film. But there's like a scene where there's a little girl against, it's like an underwater research station. And then there's of course a big shark outside. No. And it's kind of that kind of space where you come through all these really dark sort of abandoned passages and it opens out into the space that really makes, it's very beautiful. It's quite like you feel a sense of like danger. And if you sit and look, there's like a big shadow that like passes past the window, something large and probably not very friendly swimming around outside. And it kind of, there's a kind of wonder to that style of science fiction that I think Foundation, like the Isaac Asimov books, do toy with. And it kind of brings you back to that after doing this sort of messy, yucky fighting. It kind of says, but look at where you are. And yeah. I just love that mission. And I haven't played Destiny 2 in a really long time. And then the other one that came to mind, and I was like, oh, of course, it was The Sims 2 Strange Town. That, like, yes. area in there, which is probably, like, has such a, like, long-lasting legacy on The Sims franchise in general. And, like, it doesn't have any exposition, right, because it's The Sims. Like, it doesn't really explain to you. You don't go like, oh, you're moving here. You just make your household and you plunk them in there. But then, of course, the different families in that town, like, one of the women has a full graveyard and it's implied they're all her dead partners that she's murdered for money. And then there's a family who have, like, a full science lab and they have this person living with them who's not related to them who's called Nervous.
Nervous subject.
And he's clearly being, the implication is they're testing on this person, and then if you sort of like look through the family trees and stuff, you see like weird interpersonal relationships. And it was only last night when I was thinking about it, because they've made so many spin-offs from that particular town. I think The Sims 2 was probably one of the more haunting Sims games, and a lot of it's sort of like sub-narratives, and they made that terrifying DS game about Stranger Girl that people think is like haunted, and fair enough, because it was terrifying. And then, you know, like in the new franchises, they've made like a Strangerville add-on, which kind of is alluding to the same place, but maybe it was like the time in my life that I played that game that it just kind of like wedged itself.
There's something into about my brain. I think older games and the way they did things, just everything seemed a bit more spooky.
Yeah.
I went through a phase where I was watching Plumbella videos, but only YouTuber I like, and she did some videos on lots on Stranger Town and Strangerville, and it was funny because there were things that I didn't realize when I was younger, like, you know, you say family tree, I also didn't remember you could look at the family tree, but the memories, and she was like, oh, you can look at the memories, and they have, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing the amount of detail that's in these things that they've just placed in there, like you say, like, you have to go looking for it. Like, you have to bother to read the bio on the neighbourhood. You have to bother to go through the memories of the families when you click on them.
You have to sort of look at the items around the different characters as well.
It's such a... I'm so glad you mentioned this as an example, because I think it's something that we know fairly well, but it doesn't come to mind instantly. And it's actually quite innovative, again, for a Sim-style game to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. I think as well, perhaps, maybe this was a contributing factor, is that when that game came out, we weren't as, like, connected as we were now. So it almost became, like, this lore that people would maybe talk about on these, like, you know, dinky, like, web forums, or it was less accessible. Whereas now you can just YouTube, like, you That's know, true. Like I did last night, Lore of Destiny. It was like, what actually happens in this game? But, yeah, it was, and that almost becomes a sort of game in itself, trying to, like, think about, oh, like, why is this here? And I guess, especially, like, because I was younger when I played it, you kind of imagine, you start to fill in the gaps yourself as well through these little details.
Mm.
And, you know, like, the fact that there's, like, a fake Bella Goth wandering around town and all these little...
Everyone's like, what happened to Bella Goth?
And, you know, there was probably some kind of narrative they had in mind, but they only put half of it in there. So you're kind of left to...
play with the
rest
pieces.
Out. Yeah.
I like that.
So yeah, that's one that didn't come to mind straight away, but I think actually for me it was probably one of my favorite experiences of environmental storytelling in a game.
Awesome.
Yeah, fantastic. I was going to say, I think that, I guess that is the magic of environmental storytelling for me is when it acts as a form of like mystery, right? Or you're unfurling a mystery and collecting the pieces and interacting with the environment. I feel like if it's environmental storytelling that has to be kind of aided by a primary narrative, it just doesn't hit the same as what it does when there's that intentional decision by the developers to be like, okay, let's step back from it. Let's omit some details and allow this space of interpretation you know, to be created for the player.
It's funny you say this because it makes me think, because when we talk about what games we like, I always say, you know, I like a good detective game. and I think that's the thing. It's the enjoyment and the excitement you get from piecing bits together and the problem solving. And like, it's like after you finish like a game, sometimes I'll go and be like, okay, now I need to understand what other people think about this because I think it's this and maybe they have some other evidence and they look at it differently. And it's really exciting when you do that. It's funny. Yeah, putting it that way is kind of cool, like the detective being kind of part of it, the mystery solving. Yeah.
There's a really interesting book, which I'm yet to read, but it is on my very tall pile of things I should read. And I forget the author's name. It eludes me. But it's called Agency as Art, and it came out last year. And its premise is kind of like part of what makes games art forms or artistic is that agency of the player. Like, that's kind of the way it's arguing that that's the way that players artistically engage with games as art, is because they kind of get to have some agency with how they interact with the world, which, you know, not necessarily everyone agrees with, as is always the case with academic work, but it looks like a really interesting
book.
Yeah,
cool.
Well, I was going to go into Bloodborne, but because we've kind of, you know, we've shifted the conversation to the more theoretical, why don't we move on to getting into the nitty-gritty of what environmental storytelling actually is?
So, yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty and talk a bit more about the theory of environmental storytelling. I'll jump in because I did some research on this. One person who looks at this is Goins, and I'll put all of these in the reference list. And they said that games create stories through the interactions of three components. First, the organization of high-level scene structures and interactions. Two, environments or spaces filled with symbolic objects and metaphors. And three, interactions with the game world that occur over time. So in this sense, I guess we can understand environmental storytelling as one element within other elements where stories are created. Jenkins, who is super, super famous, of course, says that game designers don't simply tell stories, they design worlds and sculpt spaces. So environmental storytelling is obviously very much about having the story be generated through the environment, not necessarily like you talking to other characters or being told what's happening through missions and things like that. It's just what's around you. And Jenkins also says that narrative comprehension is an active process where viewers assemble and make hypotheses about likely narrative development on the basis of information drawn from textual cues and clues, which I really like because that connects to what we were just saying about the detectiving kind of stuff.
Yes.
Like, it's kind of, it's treating you as a player, as someone who is capable of making these kinds of connections yourself. It's giving you little breadcrumbs to follow, and it's the game of that, which I really enjoy. And Jenkins talks about a few different kinds of narratives that happen in the game. One he says is relatively unstructured and it's controlled by the player as they explore the game space and unlock its secrets. Another little quote I like. And the other is pre-structured but embedded in the mise-en-scene awaiting discovery. In this way, the game world becomes a kind of information space or a memory palace. So again, it's that I get very excited when I talk about this because I think it's like, oh, there's this space that we can explore and make connections and figure it out for ourselves. And so I think this is kind of a nice overview. It's pretty clear, I guess, what environmental storytelling is in this context.
that phrase, a memory palace.
Yeah.
Very evocative.
Yeah, yeah. I've almost felt like it was a bit tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. I wasn't sure. It makes me think of, like, Sherlock or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I did find, so there were, like, the theorists I found. And I did find there are a lot of game designers, of course, who talk about environmental storytelling. And I'll put them in the ref list because there's a bunch and I won't list them through here. But they're super interesting, of course. And the people who've worked on games and said, this is the approach we took and this is how it worked out in practice, which is awesome. But there was one person in particular, and I've read them a few times, so it really stood out to me. And Carson, and they're a theme park designer who then talks about game design, which is really cool because I never thought about theme park design, you know? Like, I've probably been to a theme park twice in my life. I'm not a big theme park person. But then I reflect on it, and I'm like, yeah, you are telling stories through the environment. That's exactly what you're doing here. And he said, the first secret is here is story. So, and when he says story, he's not talking about the linear once upon a time story. I'm talking about an all-encompassing notion, a big picture idea of the world that is being created. Which, yeah, like, again, clearly environmental storytelling in the sense that it's like, what is this world like? What's the economic situation? What's the historic situation? Blah, blah, blah. But again, linking that to theme parks, I thought, wow, there's so many overlaps here that we can look into. And in terms of other academic work, there's mostly theses. Looking at specific games. One's looking at Red Dead 2 and one's looking at Dark Souls 2. So I thought, oh, there's something for us in here. And they also found some master's projects who were looking at mise-en-scene and place. But yeah, that's pretty much what I found in terms of theory.
Fantastic. I just had a little browse on the internet, you know, Google Scholar, environmental storytelling. And I found this really, really interesting and fascinating study by Nielsen et al. 2020. They actually conducted a study that explored player experience and reception of environmental storytelling in games that employ procedural content generation.
Ah.
So what they did was they made a game, right? And they had one game where, you know, all your staged areas and, you know, the sort of environmental storytelling was static. So the scenes that you're going into, and another form of the game where, you know, the environment was actually procedurally generated, right? And so what they found was in the control group, so the people that played the game that was static, and then in the experimental group, so the people that played the game that was procedurally generated, there was very little difference in terms of how they actually experienced the narrative.
Wow.
And I found that incredibly intriguing. Incredibly intriguing because it really goes to show that, you know, the symbolic objects that are placed within an environment, even if they're shown, you know, in an order that's not necessarily static or fixed, people can still piece together what a narrative is actually trying to present, that or what an environment is trying to present. And yeah, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So the objects were the same in both. It was just that the second one, they didn't necessarily appear in the right order.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, yeah, I was just like, wow.
Yeah. I'm quite surprised, I think, because I think this is very much my bias. I think of procedural and I think, oh, no, it's going to be random and it's not going to make sense. And, you know, like, I think, oh, it's going to be a bit weird and not be quite right. But obviously not, necessarily. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't really have much to say other than it would be really interesting to see in the future if there are more studies done on this and in environmental storytelling to see if there are significant differences, particularly between, like, different genres, for example. If there is something significant there between the way that people receive stories. But from this study, it seems like, no, the sort of receptiveness of these objects is enough that you can piece together narratives, even if they aren't necessarily linear. And yeah, I find that fascinating. I'm not a person that really plays procedurally generated games, so I can't really speak to my own experience with them in this regard. What about you guys? Have you played many?
Not really. I know of some. I think the ones I know of tend to be roguelites and things, and that's not necessarily my cup of tea, so I haven't gone into it for that reason. And I do think, yeah, like I said, I think at the back of my mind I'm probably a bit biased and tend to think, oh, the storytelling won't be so strong in this game, which is not quite right, I think, now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the only like fully procedurally generated game I've played is No Man's Sky.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I can't remember. I do remember when it came out, reading about how it works. I can't remember that now. I know I quite enjoyed it. I think it's quite a relaxing game. It depends how you go into it. And I actually quite liked throughout the different worlds, you can find these different things, like there might be terminals or old bits of architecture, which really gradually tell you something about what's happening in this world, or, you know, universe. I can't remember how big it is.
It's okay.
This endless space that they created. And I really enjoyed those little moments. And they felt quite haunting and kind of sad to me, because it was such a lonely game when it first released. Like, you couldn't really talk to any of the vendors because they would speak a different language, and you could only learn the language from collecting individual words from these little randomized places that generated. And I can understand why people didn't like it, because it's quite isolating, and again, it's that conflict between what the game actually is and how they market it in order to meet budget for sales is sometimes quite different.
Yeah, no,
and
that was a big issue.
That was a big, it suffered from that. I know now it's quite different. You can build bases, you can kind of create a bit more of a stable space, whereas in the base game it was literally just like you need to keep going through these different planets where there isn't that much to do in theory, compared to a game like Dragon Age Inquisition, where it's like, here's a million quest markers and you can go, and we're going to set it out very clearly for you.
And I guess
you.
The difference, I think of Minecraft when I think of procedure, but I guess the difference there is like, all right, well, the first thing you need to do is create some kind of base, because you need to make sure you've got food and that you don't kill by skeletons at night and da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So there's a bit more directedness, I suppose.
Yeah, and then the other game I played, which I don't think falls necessarily into procedurally generated, but Hades by Supergiant Games, the order of the rooms, it's a roguelite, the order of the rooms does change. Mm-hmm. There is a structure to it, though, so I don't think it necessarily falls into that box, but it's kind of like a gentle procedural thing, in that you get different rooms in different orders. On each run, you might meet a different character, because they only appear at a sort of random sort of chance generator. So, like, one of my favorite characters is Thanatos, who's the god of death, and he'll only arrive, you know, based on chance. So, like, if you want to progress his storyline within the game, that's chance. Like, it's not guaranteed that you will see him every time you run through the various dungeons.
And just thinking, this is probably completely out of left field, but I've been doing some reading lately, I say, on heebie-jeebie things, because I've been playing Phasmophobia. I found a book in the library about modern demon possession, and I was like, what? This is great. Like, I'm just into that now. I'm just curious. And it's funny, because thinking about divination and tarot and stuff, I think about this as a form of divination, because I would, I would probably be like, ooh, like, who's the first character that I got by chance? What does that mean? Like, do I feel like I have things related to this character? Like, I feel like I would, even not believing in this stuff so strictly, I would still think, what does that mean that I got that character?
Yeah. Like, I think we naturally try and create meaning between things. That's where, like, you know, even if you're not necessarily superstitious, you may have some weird sort of omen type things.
Yeah.
Like, I won't open my umbrella under a roof. I have, like, no basis through which, like, there's no reason.
I just don't
I've
do
not
that.
Okay. had a bad experience from doing that, but it's just, you try and make sense of things that don't necessarily connect. Yeah, I totally get that. And, like, in Hades, like, there's certain levels where you will get, like, there's a boss at the end of each kind of dungeon area, let's say, and they will change. So, like, in the first one, the bosses are the Furies, but you'll get a different one. At the start, you just get the one, and then they start to change it up. And sometimes you might get there, and you've got a weapon that is rubbish against the one you end up getting, and you're like, great, this is going to be a lot harder or a lot easier, depending on what you get. So, yeah, I don't know if I would describe that as a procedurally generated game. It's got a lot of structure to it. But, yeah, it's a way of maybe integrating that into a world.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So now we'll talk a bit more in depth about some specific games that we really enjoy the environmental storytelling in. So I'll go first, and I will talk about BioShock, because this game, to be honest, I always bang on about it, because this is the game that got me into, I say, modern games. If that makes sense, because I was very much like, I had my PS1 and my PS2, and I was playing, like, I don't know, Spyro, Akami, like these kind of light games. And then from the Royal Show one year, I got, you know, them show bags for PC Gamer or whatever, mm-hmm. and you get like 10 magazines that didn't sell, but they came with demo discs. And I got a demo disc for BioShock, and I thought, okay, let's give this a go. And oh my God, I like started the game, and I completely like shut my pants almost. It was terrifying. Oh my God, it was so scary. Because like water starts pouring. First start, right? Like, I like a swim, but I'm not great. I'm not great with the ocean. Like
perfect game for you,
though. Yeah. Like, I'm just not the ocean. Like, I'll happily have a swim and all that sort of stuff, but just my two things I always say are the worst things. Why would you go to space? And why would you go deep under the ocean where both times you can't breathe? I just don't, that's why I like these horror things so much, like in space and under the sea. So yeah, basically water started pouring in and I was like, and I freaked out. And I was quite young and it was the middle of the day, but I had the blind shut. So that was as scary as I got. And I just completely freaked out and didn't play. And I think maybe a few months later, I finally got the courage to try again. So it already had such a strong like effect on me. It was like my introduction to like a more adult game, a shooter and a scary game, and it was all bundled into one. So I guess like, in terms of gameplay, people always say, I played my first shooter, and then they say, that's not a shooter, it's sort of FPS game. And I'm like, yeah, all right, but you shoot a gun and you aim. Sorry, to me, it was like my introduction.
What more could you ask for?
Exactly. And I saw that the creator of the game, Gardner, he said we wanted to make a shooter, but we actually wanted to make one with narrative and specifically one with environmental storytelling. So I was like, okay, now I kind of have a better idea of why this game spoke to me so much as a shooter, and I say that with air quotes now. Because I loved BioShock for its storytelling. Like, I was so fascinated by this world under the sea and how it was created and what life was like there and what went wrong and all these little interactions between people and groups that led to like it ultimately kind of failing. And I explored all the levels really meticulously, like I would go to every single corner and every single secret like hidden room, and you know, you have to like hack things by shooting a dart through a window or trying to find a code, and I would be like, I have to do all of them because I want to find out so much about this world. And I would pay attention to like all the little signs and the ways that, like, the items were arranged that would tell you something, like, what happened in this room. And, like, what the splicers were saying when they thought I wasn't there. Like, because they would argue with each other or sing a song or like, just talk to themselves. And you'd be picking up constantly on, like, oh, okay, so, like, what happened to you and what are you upset about or whatever. But I think really what I think BioShock kind of pioneered, to my understanding, is the audio recordings as a mechanic, because you would go through and pick up audio recording and have a little picture in the bottom of your screen with the picture of like the person, so you have a little connection with, okay, I have some vague idea of what this person was like, and you'd hear audio recording of them like reflecting on something that happened when they were around. And it was really insightful and worked really well, because instead of pausing the game and having to read some text on the screen while you're getting shot at, it would be like, okay, I can quickly listen to this while I'm walking through it. Kind of made a bit more sense in that way. And there's so much on sound, I think, in BioShock.
Mm.
Like, accents are quite important. Like, you have the noise from the ammo machine singing at you. You have splicers yelling in the background. You're always listening. And for Big Daddies, if you hear groaning, then you're like, uh-oh. You know, like, you have to always be listening to what's going on. So I think in that way, audio was quite important. And I also enjoyed, like, the immersive Art Deco kind of style of the game. Because when I looked at some screenshots I took years ago, I noticed, like, the lighting is, you know, very Art Deco in the sense that you've got these archways and these ridges and things, and then there's some neon lights, particularly being under the water, the way it, like, permeates through the water is quite eerie. It's quite soft. And it reflects on the water that's pouring in. So you have... when you look at it for a moment, I think, oh, my God, my eyes are so confused because you've got reflections everywhere and little bits and darkness everywhere. And you see these huge, beautiful windows where the ocean is outside and you've got, like, a Big Daddy doing work on the outside of Rapture, or you've got, like, a splicer floating past, or fish, and this eerie sound, like, it's just very... For me, I always say, such a stereotype to say, but I always say it's so immersive. Like, I really felt like, wow, you're in this, you're literally surrounded in all possible ways by this world. And like I said before, I really like the detectiving. I very much see it as, like, getting juicy clues and trying to figure out what's going on. And they do that a lot in this game. That's kind of like what embedded narratives are kind of all mm-hmm. about. And I saw Bill Gardner, who helped create the game, he said that every single room, is about getting across a very specific idea. And the amount of effort that goes into that, you know, like for me, you run through a room so quickly, you might not even spend 5 seconds in there. But they really put a lot of work into designing these spaces. Like sometimes you might find like a body in a weird position, or the auto diary maybe is nearby and it kind of explains what happened to them, that kind of thing. And there's an author I read called Sikowski, and he does a really good job of explaining this kind of stuff, because he says in Rapture, space is power. So, which, you know, makes sense. You're in this underwater mm-hmm. city, you know, real estate is a prime kind of thing. Like, you can't make space very easily. So that's reflected in the economics, mm-hmm. which I was like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. And that's therefore supported by the art, the propaganda that you see in the world. So in that sense, I'm getting a real nice, broad, like, picture in my head about, like, what this society values, what it's like, what the conflicts are about. Because at the same time, there was dissent everywhere. Like, religion was banned, but you, in the docks, you find these boxes of Bibles that people were secretly importing. And, you know, you have Fontaine versus Ryan, and in Bioshock 2, you have Lamb. And so it's so fascinating to see all these conflicts between all these different groups. But, like, if I zoomed out a bit, I would say, like, the opening in particular to this game is so strong. Like, the lighthouse is literally a portal to another world. And they always say this in Bioshock 1 and 2 and in Infinite, and they say, like, there's always a lighthouse, there's always a man, there's always, you know, this kind of thing. And it's very, like, that's the signifier. It's so important to understand you're now entering a new space. Almost like in Shinto, when you walk through the Torii gate, it's almost like this. It's like, okay, here is that structure. Now you're in a new space. And I found that really symbolic, I guess. And, so when I watched the doco by Gardner, and I'll put the link in the references, he talks specifically about designing those opening moments and how powerful and impactful that scene is. And he's totally right. Like, you're panicking because you're urgent. You're like, oh, my God, I've just crashed in a plane and I'm in the middle of the ocean. But you're also in awe because you're like, there's this huge, amazing tower. Also, the graphics look kind of amazing. I've never seen water look like that before with the fire, like, reflection and all that. You're like, where am I? And then once you go down into the lighthouse, you know, you're bombarded by propaganda on your way down and you're like, what is this? then the bathysphere is broken. There's all these scary people around me and I'm still stressed and don't know what to do next. And he says the awe comes from that you haven't seen these things before. And I think that's partly for me why, being the first adult game I played, it was all so unbelievably new. So, yeah, being able to have so much richness of storytelling in so many different ways and feeling so immersed, that game I always say will be so powerful for me because it was really my introduction to what games can do. And it really blew me away. Yeah.
I think it's easy to forget now how influential so many of its design techniques and narrative techniques were. Like, so many, like, audio recordings and, you know, finding the Bibles. I feel like so many games really... There's a few games, I think, that are just, like, milestone games and that they do something really interesting with mechanics. I think Bioshock is absolutely one of them.
I was going to say, I wonder if it's going to experience or is experiencing the Seinfeld effect in a way, because those techniques are so common now. Like, I wonder if the legacy of BioShock will hold up. Like, will we continue to see it as this kind of propagator of these certain mechanics, or because they are so mainstream and common now, if we're just going to see it as more of a genre type of, like, characteristic, so to speak. I find it interesting because I guess with the Seinfeld effect, right, it's when people watch Seinfeld now, they're like, they don't find it funny because they've seen those tropes that Seinfeld created appear again and again in comedy. And I'm like, it'd be interesting to see how the new BioShock goes, because will it be innovative again? Will we have the same sort of experience, or a similar experience with it now? Or, you know, are the critics going to jump on it and say, this is repetitive, this is generic? I'm really interested to see what they'll do.
It's so subjective. It's funny you say Seinfeld, because I have just recently rewatched it again for, like, first time since I was really young. And, like, I literally am starting it again, like, a second time in a row. And I'm like, I do find it funny. And I'm thinking, okay, so, yeah, like, what games, I'm trying to reflect here on, like, what games I think are repetitive versus what I think isn't. Because clearly I do enjoy some repetition. What's the key difference?
Well, it is funny because I'm the same. I mean, I did watch some Seinfeld as a child, and I've watched it as an adult, and I do find Seinfeld hilarious, like, even if it does use the same tropes. But there definitely seems to be this, I guess, this discourse. I mean, we've talked about it before on the podcast about, like, technological progression and consistent desire to progress within the game's development space.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it depends a bit on if you find the innovations enjoyable. Like I said, like, I like open world, but I don't like the feeling of collectathon. But when it's done well, I really enjoy it. So I guess if it feels like all the elements are working together well, maybe older elements are okay, but newness for the sake of newness can sometimes not be done so well. I don't know.
I feel like that early 2010s period in games, there were a few games that came out that just became almost like hallmark reference points, because we had BioShock, you had Skyrim come out at the same time.
Akami came out in 2006, and that was pretty revolutionary.
Yeah, The Witcher wasn't that far behind also, and these games have really informed probably all the games that have come out in the next 5 years. I played Assassin's Creed Valhalla this year, and that is very much like, okay, how can we take everything that was fun and, you know, mix it into this game? And I do really enjoy that game, but it's kind of like, it's like Skyrim crossed with Animal Crossing, crossed with Assassin's Creed. Like, there's a lot going on, crossed with, you know, Dragon Age. It feels more like a fantasy RPG than a, let's say, a traditional Assassin's Creed game, whatever that statement means.
No, I would agree with you absolutely there. Like,
yeah. But yeah, I think BioShock is part. And the one thing I wonder as well as BioShock has such a distinctive art style. And I think sometimes that gives a bit of timelessness to certain games, because if you're aiming for realism, it's going to be outdated because the technology continues to improve. Whereas when you have such a clear artistic vision, it doesn't feel old necessarily. It might just feel like it's of a particular movement or feeling. Like,
yeah. And I think that BioShock still is the dominant game in regards to that aesthetic, like that Art Deco aesthetic in particular. I know that We Happy Few kind of infused that, it was critically mixed. I feel like it's kind of very. So I feel like when I think about, you know, like Art Deco and like horror themes, like, it always comes back to, and I mean, just AAA games generally in open world. Well, although BioShock is more linear, isn't it? But has like some open world elements.
I guess, like, I mean, there are, the levels are big, and you explore the levels. Generally, the whole level is open to you unless there's certain doors that have to be unlocked after certain points. But, like, yeah, so you can explore the level itself at your own leisure, I suppose, generally. But there's a clear, like,
there's
okay, then you find this.
I feel like, for me at least, and I played Infinite first, which is kind of weird, a weird approach to doing it, story-wise especially, because there are points where you're like, clearly, like, this is referencing something important, but it's totally going over my head. And I still think that game is really beautiful, like, especially, again, they just, like, nailed the opening scene.
It's like it's a kick. It's like, right, you're here. This is what's happening.
I love it.
This stuff's crazy. Yeah.
And I think a sort of spiritual successor that does dabble in that open world but isn't quite as Dishonored, which kind of that sort of steampunky atmosphere. And you can move a lot within the world, but it is kind of contained. And I think they're clearly very influenced by the environmental storytelling of games like Bioshock, because in Dishonored, of course, you carry the heart, which essentially gives a similar effect. It's not an audio recording, but it will tell you different little narratives around.
Yeah, you're right. Now I'm thinking about it. I'm like, oh, yeah.
So perhaps, like, if I can imagine an open world Bioshock that perhaps is like almost like a limited open world space.
I'm quite keen, I have to admit.
Well, I can't remember. There was a press release saying that they're planning.
Yeah, there was a logo. And they said it looked like it was going to be, the tower seems to be what do you call it? Like a panopticon, like a prison tower type thing.
Oh, yeah.
And there's these two nations or something, and there's a wall. It's very like army sort of military political, I get the feeling. So interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah.
It's a very good game to think about for environmental storytelling, I think. I think even if you haven't played Bioshock, everyone's like, oh, yeah. But it's one of those games. It's almost like a classic novel. Like, I don't know if every single person who raves about it has necessarily played it.
Funny.
In as much detail as someone like you has done.
I was upset. You could download the skyboxes and things off certain subreddits. People figured out how to extract things from the game. Yeah. And I would just look at them and be like, wow.
I think it's probably a classic. Like, if we were going to put certain games in that frame, it's a game that I think is cross-referenced a lot. Even that level in Destiny, it's like, oh yeah, this is a little bit like Rapture and those big windows and
absolutely. Awesome.
Fantastic. So I guess moving on, what I chose as my example was actually Joel's house and your exploration of it as Ellie in The Last of Us Part 2. If you're listening and you want to play The Last of Us Part 2 and you don't want to be spoiled, please skip ahead until I stop talking because there's going to be massive spoilers here. So you visit Joel's house as Ellie after he has died, and he's died in quite a brutal way, and Ellie is thrust into this really negative mental space where she's having to deal with grief. As she explores Joel's house, where the environmental storytelling really comes in here is that every object in this house, and I mean the house overall, its aesthetic, it's kind of like warm farmhouse, like going back to your roots type of vibe that it gives off. It's all done in a way to humanize the character of Joel. So in The Last of Us Part 1, we know that Joel has quite a shady background during the first few years of the zombie apocalypse. I don't know if he was necessarily a traitor or a slaver, but he was something that had something to do with the movement of people. And we know that in the Last of Us universe, these people are generally depicted as enemies. And the way in which he has been effectively, the way in which he is kind of shut down emotionally in order to deal with the zombie apocalypse has made him become quite a violent person, essentially. Unfortunately, he's had to adapt to, you know, his surroundings, and as a result, it's made a man that, you know, is kind of stuck in time. He's stuck at this time where his daughter died at the hands of zombies and law enforcement that, you know, failed to really contain the threat, and he's never really let it go. However, we know that in meeting Ellie, he's able to kind of come to grips with his past a little more and kind of find love, parental love in the apocalypse. And what I found really, I guess, touching about Joel's house is the fact that as we're going through it, we can kind of see, for example, on his fireplace, there's a decorative clock there, but the other object on the clock is a drawing from Ellie of himself. I know.
There were a few moments exploring that where I was like, my heart is hurting.
Yes. And there's another room that he has dedicated to guitars, and we know that the relationship between Ellie and Joel at this point is kind of is hanging by a thread, and their connection is kind of established through music. That's kind of how they're connecting to one another at the moment. And just seeing, like, specific records in his house, for example, the fact that he has a record player living in this little settlement in the zombie apocalypse, it's like there's still part of himself of himself before the apocalypse that still exists. And I really like this because I feel like sometimes, I feel like Joel is just kind of put into this box of, Joel's a bad man, right? Mm. Like, he's a bad man, but I feel like, it's like, yes, but he's a complex man. And I feel like that's what moving as Ellie around this house really established, is that, yes, Joel was a violent man. However, there was still parts of himself that were quite human. He had likes and dislikes. He had taste. Like, my first feeling of walking into the house as Ellie was like, holy shit, like Joanna and Chip Gaines, you know, Fixer Upper on HGTV. This is the this is their kind of work. This is a home.
Yeah.
This is a home. And the fact that it's so clean and, you know, it's well decorated with like animal like carvings and cushions and like cute little mugs and I don't know, there's something about it that really touched me. And I mean, it is a highly emotive stage in the game, obviously, in the narrative, and it's placed there to really, like, really entrench that, to really make you feel like, Joel, no, why? There's also a particular scene, so it's towards the end of this part of the chapter. You go upstairs and you go to Joel's bedroom and you find a box on his bed, and in interacting with the box you find a watch. And the lore of the watch in The Last of Us is that the watch was given to Joel by his biological daughter Sarah, who died at the beginning of the zombie apocalypse, and even though it's broken, he's never taken it off. So the fact that Ellie picks it up and she kind of just stares at it, she doesn't say anything. And I think this is really important as well. Ellie doesn't say very much in the house. It's very little dialogue in there. So everything that we're seeing, particularly with her interacting with the objects, you as the viewer are kind of projecting or interpreting what is happening here. And it's this sense of loss. In the bedroom, you also go into his closet and you can see Ellie kind of going through his jackets and you're like, oh, okay, she's going to take one, like she took the watch and his Glock, if that's a Glock, a revolver, something, a gun. So she's going through the closet and she picks up one of his jackets and you're like, okay, is she going to take this with her? She doesn't. She smells it. And it's like one of those moments where
I was just taken aback.
And the environmental storytelling in this scene, I think, is just incredible. The fact that there is such little dialogue, the fact that not everything is able to actually be interacted with, but you feel as if you're in this space and you're putting everything together and you're really kind of, it feels like a eulogy to Joel in a way from Ellie. I thought it was fantastic. Obviously, The Last of Us as a game series is pretty phenomenal when it comes to environmental storytelling. I always think about, you know, when you see like that really edgy graffiti in games where it's like, we're all like murder, zombies. And also like the fact that you're constantly picking up, all kinds of different documents and like media forms throughout. It really does go the extra mile in trying to really depict the social relationships and lives of people before and after the apocalypse and how that has actually impacted the people that they've become. So yeah, I found it fantastic, really. And I really liked the fact that the way that Ellie was kind of picking things up and the fact that she kept the watch and the Glock, obviously the kind of item inventory system that you have in The Last of Us, it's use and toss. It's really unforgiving. This is a survival, it's a survival horror game. Of course, you have to use your items. I mean, you can hoard them as well, but usually you're just constantly going through a cycle of them, right? And so there was something about her, picking these certain things up and holding them close to her that I found a bit impactful. Like, this is what tethers her, right? And she's lost that. And
that's such a good point. Yeah. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a throwaway versus no, this is valuable. Yeah.
Yeah. So I found it impactful and I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of The Last of Us. I mean, I do like the games, but they're not my favourite games. But I feel like in terms of environmental storytelling, they do a really good job.
It's so interesting. One that comes to mind for me is like the difference. I'm like banging on about audio in Bioshock, but the difference here is that it's actually really important that it's quiet and that for once it's reflection time and you're like, what is she thinking? And maybe she is just thinking silence. Like, it's I think something that hit me quite hard in that scene was, it's so devastating because this whole game, like, she's not having a relationship with him anymore because she finds out that he could have, created a cure of da-da-da. And you go, okay, I understand, but it's so upsetting because he looks so cut up about it. And I felt so bad for him. And I was like, I get why she's upset, of course, but he's just trying to look out for you because he cares about you. And it was so gut-wrenching to see this play out. And then, you get to the house and you kind of see her go, it's too late to reconcile now. You know, like, after she was quite, she said some harsh words to him and was quite cold to him, and it was so sad. And then he's gone, and she can't reconcile now because, you know, like, and that was really sad. It hit me really deep. Like, I felt really upset about it.
Me too. It's very powerful. It was. There's this, so when you do go upstairs, there's a dresser, right? And the first photo that you come across is that of Joel and Sarah. Mm-hmm. But then you move across the dresser and there's a photograph of Joel and Ellie. And so you know that it was kind of quite symbolic of the fact that it's equal. Like, he actually sees her as his daughter. Yeah. Or but the same sort of, he has the same sort of love there. And so, yeah, it's just, it's like, just so twists sad. That knife further in my heart.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. Like, yeah, it's just sad. And I guess that's how the game is so interesting in that sense. Like, there's so much on redemption and on forgiveness and on grudges. And that's kind of what it's all about, I guess. And it's just heartbreaking in a lot of ways.
It is.
It's very, yeah. It's fascinating. It's I like it. I love it as an example in contrast because it's about reflection.
It is.
I think. And I kind of like, I like the idea that you can have environmental storytelling, you know, like bam, 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 I'm going through these levels and I'm reading all this stuff and taking in all this information. It can be quiet reflection time. Yes. And it's kind of a nice example of how it can be done in a few different ways, I guess.
And I feel like that feeds into what you were saying about problem solving as well, because it's like, you know, problem solving inside your own, you know, in your head where you're like going around, you're like trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
I like that.
And you're trying to think, what's she thinking? Yes. What processes is she going through? Am I projecting my own thoughts onto that? Yes, obviously. But yeah.
And I think too, like, the fact that that scene is so early in the game and we haven't kind of seen everything that went down between Ellie and Joel at that point, like, reflecting upon that scene later, you're like, you know, if I'd known these things back then, like, would I feel like this scene would have been a lot worse. So I can see why that they placed it early on, so you as the player can kind of mourn Joel as well and not have, like, the more complex feelings that you develop later on regarding his decision. I mean, I never had complex feelings because I think he did the right thing. They were never going to make that vaccine in that post-apocalyptic world. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There's not enough. It takes years.
It's a bit optimistic. Especially after having gone through COVID, now I have a bit of a, I have a little bit more idea about what's involved.
I haven't played The Last of Us because, well, I have played a little bit of it, but I'm not a huge zombie-related franchise player. But is there, like, in that moment as well, I guess you're also reflecting because you were Joel, right?
Yes,
absolutely.
Does that add another dimension?
As a player, you're mourning who you were.
Yeah. Anyway, we should move on.
Yeah.
Such an interesting game to talk about, though. Both of them. Yeah, well, for me, a game that I really love and think does a really great job with environmental storytelling is Cyberpunk 2077. I, you know, love that it's a bit hated also. For a long time, I was really keen to play this game. And then, well before the sort of hype cycle really kicked off for it. And it's very much the game I wanted to play, perhaps not the game everyone else wanted to play. That's okay. Mm-hmm. They still made plenty of money. They'll be fine. And I played it not long after I'd moved back to Perth from London, which are two very different cities. And, you know, London is a big city. There's 10 million people just in a really small space. And I remember I'd been here a couple of months. And Perth is a city too, but it's a lot smaller and it's built very differently. And there's a different pressures on the city. And I remember playing it and just feeling like, yeah, like, they've really got this feeling of being in this massive city, right? And I think a lot of games that are shooters, and I'm thinking games like Grand Theft Auto and Saints Row, they're kind of constructed around a narrative of power, right? You can like win the city, you can be the best in the city, whereas the reality, if you live in a big city, is that your individual scope and power is quite small because there's so many people. And it's not that you don't have it, it's just like, something I love about Londoners is everyone has a kind of bubble, and it's kind of, you know, people go, oh, like, Londoners, they're so rude. Actually, it's just a kind of mutual respect thing. It's like, it's really crowded on this train and I just kind of want to space out and listen to my music, and I'm not going to get in your space, and you're not going to get in mine. And your bubble's pretty small because it's pretty packed. Sometimes the standoffishness is just a kind of mutual
I hear respect. This before when people talk about, I've never been to America, but I hear stories from people who are like, oh, people in New York, everyone's grumpy and everyone like, get out of my way and rah, rah, rah. And the first thing that comes to mind is like, well, it's because they have to deal with a million people every day in their daily life. Like, you would be, it's even being in Japan, being in Tokyo, like, loved it to bits, obviously. But it was lovely at the end of being in Tokyo for a week to go out into the more rural area because it was like, oh, it was a bit more relaxing because it's pretty exhausting having so many people around all the time. Like,
everyone builds up sort of like collective ways to cope. It's kind of like this mutual agreement that no one has to say, but you just understand that that's going to make it nicer for everyone. And I remember coming back to Perth and just, it took me weeks to adjust to, hey, how are you? At like every single shop, I was like, oh my God, like, why are you talking to me? Like, you don't need, it took a little while. It took some time. And playing Cyberpunk, I was like, And for reference, I love living in London. It wasn't a problem. It's just part of the atmosphere of that place. And there's a quest really early on in Cyberpunk, and it's just a side quest, and it's like, oh, basically this police officer, she is being too good, essentially. She's looking out for a gang or something like that, but it's a gang that is in cahoots with the police, and the gang is after her. I'm, you know, could be getting this slightly wrong, but basically you're a mercenary. That's how you make your money. And one of the fixers, who's a person who's basically like, they're essentially a quest giver, but they've kind of, any like free jobs that need, you know, a hand, they'll might give you a ring and say, hey, can you go do this? Or can you go look after whatever? And they send you, can you get this person to leave this market area that they're like staking out, because they're probably going to get killed and it's going to be not a great situation for anybody. And you go and you figure out and you go and talk to her, and she's obviously a bit like cranky, and you can get her to leave, and that all kind of ends out. But then at the end of the quest, before you like close off the dialogue, you can be like, how's it going? Like, how are you? Like, you know how in like a fantasy RPG you can be like, how are you? And the person will be like, oh, this is my tragic
backstory. You have to go through every single dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. And you can say, like, your V, who's your character, can be like, so, like, what's up? And this person will be like, stop talking to me. Like, why are you interested in this? Like, please leave my apartment. And I loved that because I was like, that's such a normal reaction to that kind of behavior, and it makes so much sense.
Just because the dialogue option is available doesn't mean it makes sense in this universe,
which
is
exactly an interesting idea. And I thought that was great, and I just loved that. And I think what they do really, I mean, when they were designing Cyberpunk, they did hire architects to work on the game, and so it's whatever like people say about it, it's a big, complicated bit of work. Mm-hmm. This city, it's massive, it's really detailed, there is verticality to it, and something that they just do so well in that game is making you feel quite small in the like scope of this landscape. Because I was talking about the sort of like maybe the power fantasy of games like GTA, and in Cyberpunk that's just not what the narrative is. Like, V as a character doesn't have a lot of power. You have kind of like a choice of your origin story, and my favorite is the corpo, because you essentially start at the top and get kicked right down to the bottom, and you sort of start working for Arasaka, which is a big corporate entity in the world of Cyberpunk, and you basically get played and you lose your job and you lose everything. And I love that intro, because you start with basically an optical bit of software that shows your stocks, your emails, who's contacting you over your eyes. So it's like an implant, and then when you get kicked out of the corp, that gets taken away from you. So it's quite like a sharp
pull. Wow. You're disconnected from everything.
You're completely disconnected from that, and then you start from the bottom. And there are other, like, you know, backstories your character can have, but that one was just my favorite because it felt like a very literal fall. Like, in that introduction, you start, you like traveling in like a hover car, and you've got champagne, and it's all very, very like above ground, and then you start the actual story and you're like foot traffic, you know, you're just a pedestrian, you don't have access to that sort of like height or separation from the world, and they, in so Night City is basically hyper neoliberalistic in that the state doesn't really have much power. It's pretty much all run by a few big corporations, and they control a lot of the real estate. And there's a really great YouTube video by an architect where he talks about how well they did this, and he kind of says that he just keeps going back to the game because of this, because in that kind of world, a lot of the sort of master plans and city planning regulations that exist in modern cities, they start to fall away because the corporations own property, and so things like setbacks and stuff like that and maximum area of space a building can occupy, they don't matter because it's not driven by law necessarily, but by who owns what and who has the most economic power. So the city is very like clustered, and the buildings are huge, and you know, there's loads of different sort of architectural styles kind of all crammed on top of the other. So they, when they were like designing the world, they set out a few different eras of like architectural styles, and they, in different parts of the city, you can see how those styles kind of have built up over time or intersect. And it's very, very much like the way an actual city is, where you don't, well, except for perhaps Perth, which is built basically in a straight line, but in an older city that has existed for a long time, like London or New York, you do get these layers of city and layers of history and places where things might have been destroyed or rebuilt, and they've just, it's just incredible. Like, it really feels like that. And I think they were very, like, honest to that feeling in the game, possibly to their detriment, because it doesn't feel like a GTA game. And if that's what people were going into...
I have to admit, it makes me want to play it more.
I mean, I don't know if I was just lucky, because it's never crashed for me. And that has been, like, the thing that has plagued it in a lot of, you know, the scandal and... publicity around it, is that it doesn't run very well. And I played it on PS4 and I never had a problem with it. And all this stuff was going on in the background. I was, I'm just going to sit quietly and play this, and I'm sure it's fine. And it was. And I think cyberpunk's a tricky genre as well, because it's very cool and it's very like aesthetic. Yeah. But also it's kind of set in a dystopian world. Yeah. Like, to be true to it, things have to be difficult, right? Like, you can't. And they're not telling a story about someone who has a lot of power in this world. They're telling a story about someone who's kind of right at the bottom. And then I won't go into spoilers, but whose life gets worse quickly. You start at the bottom and you somehow
get
lower than that, which is, you know, a lot of people slip through the cracks in big cities. And that kind of happens to be. And it's not very empowering at times, because... And, you know, obviously the more you play, it still has your usual systems where, you know, you're going to get stronger, you're going to level up, you're going to get skills. And it makes sense in the plot that you're going to get better at those things. But, yeah, that feeling of being a pedestrian in a big city that has been basically designed around corporate interest rather than civilian interest is really, really good. I really enjoy it. And it does a lot without saying it. You don't actually get a lot of exposition into what Night City is when you play it. It's kind of all told through the architecture and the spaces around you, and the narrative is very focused on V. It's not the story of Night City, it's the story of V, but Night City is very much alive in the background, and there's lots of little details you can find and discover. And it, you know, like, I don't know what people wanted from a city of that size, because it's massive. But if you spend that, like, the attention to detail is really there. So yeah, that's a game that I really enjoy, the environmental storytelling.
It's on my list. I got it. We pre-ordered it and then said we got on PC. So we said, oh, we'll wait till patches come out.
Yeah.
And stuff. But I'm really keen, because it's funny when you say, like, in the city, because it's so busy, you could probably just stop and look around and be like, if you, as a character, if you look around, you might absorb narrative already, like with the building styles and stuff. You don't even, like, it's all there. If it feels, I'm thinking of, like, being stuck in the middle of Tokyo, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and looking around and being gobsmacked and just staring at everything in a circle because it's just so much. And doing that alone, you can absorb a lot.
Yeah, like, interestingly, I watched a seminar from one of the developers from The Witcher,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about how they designed Beauclair in Blood and Wine, which is the expansion pack, because they had to build this whole new city from scratch. And they talk about early on, like, they put in landmarks to orient the player in space, which is not that different to how usual cities are built. So they're like, okay, if you can see the temple, you know you're in this part of the city. And they made all these buildings, specific buildings, taller, like the town hall and the temple and the palace, which kind of, like, if you go to an old southern European city, which is what that city is based on, that is usually true. Like, you can kind of identify where you are by those landmarks, whereas Night City, you don't necessarily get that feeling always, that you can look around and be like, okay, this is where I am. Like, you might know from, like there's an area in the north that's very industrial, there's obviously, like, wealthier areas, there's areas you can kind of tell which gang has the most power in particular areas because they'll have, like, graffiti, and you'll notice the style of dress of the people around. So there are these little clues, but if they're ironically quite commercial, they're about, like, style and things like that, rather than the space itself being designed to help you, because it's not. And I'm sure that they put markers in there so that at least you didn't feel completely lost, but it is a very different atmosphere to a city like Novigrad or Beauclair in The Witcher, because it's oppressively tall. Like, if you look up, the buildings are just, you know, they just keep going above you, and you can't really get that high in the game. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
I think it's so interesting that it kind of seems like this city is untouchable. And, like, going back to what you were saying before about, like, the art of games being, you know, founded within the player's agency in the game, it's like the city obviously plays a massive part in, you know, depicting, you know, as you were saying before, what kind of power you actually receive in this game. It's kind of like, as you were saying before about GTA, like, you know, after some time, you can get, like, the best car, you can get a helicopter, you know, you can... You get all the best items, or, you know, you get those markers of, like, wealth and success. But in this game, it kind of seems like, oh, you can you can improve your life, but just a little bit. Like, you're never going to be the president of the corporation that's sitting there. You'll never be. Yeah.
Exactly. And it has, there's three endings, and one of them perhaps is, like, the closest to being a person of power. But you're, like, it's more just that you can afford to live a better life. Like, if you're being really objective about it, that's not exactly how it's framed. I'm simplifying it so I don't give it away. But clearly, like, V has kind of established a safety net around themselves that is based on a kind of income difference. Like, the difference between the apartment you're in for the whole game and that one in that ending is quite obvious. But even, as you say, it's not... There's no... You don't really... You're not the leader necessarily of anything in the way you might be in a really traditional structure of an RPG. And the other two endings are very, very different.
It's so interesting thinking about, okay, GTA maybe is a different example, but thinking about Beauclair, like, okay, typical high fantasy game, you start as no one, you become powerful, amazing, everyone loves you, da da da. Compare that to a sci-fi game. So Cyberpunk's in the future, and it's super neoliberal. You're no one. Like, you're dirt on the bottom of someone's shoe. Like, you're to achieve something great is to have a slightly better apartment, but to have a stable life. It's such a different extreme for past and for future. Like, envisioning, I find quite interesting.
Yeah, there's so much in that game. I'm probably, like, missing, like, massive chunks, but... In terms of that, like, wealth thing as well, you're talking about GTA and getting the best car. I don't know if this is just because of how I was playing, but, like, the best cars are very expensive also in Cyberpunk. It's not that you can't get them, but that, you know, it's not, like, it's probably not going to happen to you.
You have to grind.
You have to grind. And, like, for me, I was like, I can't really be bothered. And there are cars you can get for free through, like, particular quest lines and things like that, but... Yeah, it would probably be quite dull, I think, to grind for those vehicles early on. And they're not really the symbol of success in the game world that they might be in another game of a similar style.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it's I recommend playing it. I think it's a good game. But I'm also, it's also very much in a genre that I enjoy. Yeah. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think maybe that's a factor too. It is a slightly different genre of game to a GTA, and it's different to The Witcher. So if people are coming into it with those particular expectations, or if that's what they wanted, then I don't know if they could fix enough for those people to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think I like that the way you're describing it. It sounds like they've been quite faithful to the genre, right? And yeah, that's not going to meet the expectations of people that don't perceive the cyberpunk as the way that it typically is, particularly in literature, I think. Like, they saw cyberpunk and they're like, oh, this is going to be lawless. Like,
yeah.
We're going to be able to, you know, jump in like a freaking flying car or something and, like, you know, just, you know, faff around the city doing whatever we want. And when that didn't happen, it's like, you know, we're just a pleb.
It's quite a linear narrative. It is an open world, but much like The Witcher has a very central kind of driving thing. Like, you're looking for Ciri for a lot of the game. And you're like, everything you do is kind of in reference to that goal. And Cyberpunk kind of is structured in the same way. Like, you have a very specific Keanu Reeves related thing that you need to do. And everything you do is kind of connected to that. It's not just like, I'm going to go and do whatever I like. There is a narrative pressure that makes it a bit more linear, which I like. Mm. I think it's enjoyable. I think they did a really good job.
I'm quite happy with a bit of linearity in my game. I think with Inquisition, like with all the quests and stuff, I was like, oh, there's so much to do, and they're telling me to do all these extra things, and I'm a bit overwhelmed. Whereas if it's like, here's your overarching thing, and here are some little things on the way, I'm like, okay, that's manageable.
And you can, like, you know, bum around and find things to do. That's totally possible. But you can do that in The Witcher also.
Yes.
But people probably wouldn't say, I loved just, like, riding around in circles in the woods in The Witcher. They always say, oh, like, the quests were so meaningful. Mm. That's always the praise that The Witcher gets, is that all the quests felt like they were connected to something bigger or connected to Geralt's character. And
absolutely.
Yeah, which is... And also, like, we're probably running out of time, but the first-person aspect of Cyberpunk 2077 is really interesting as well, because it's not just for shooting. Like, a lot of the story kind of is impactful because you see it through that perspective. Yeah, so that would be its own paper, probably.
Yeah, we should think about, like,
first-person. But it's the architecture that, you know, for environmental storytelling immediately grabbed me about the game. And that's what, we can put the link in the references, but the architect who talks about it, he says the same thing. Like, even if the game itself wasn't exactly what he wanted, it's the world building that has made him go back again and again to play it and kind of see how it all fits together.
That's awesome.
No, it sounds incredible. Yeah, no, I do really want to play it, because again, it's like, because it's hated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because before, like, the way that Cyberpunk was marketed, it did have that edgelord kind of feel to it.
It's the risk of the Cyberpunk in general. Like, it's all like, because I remember before I was pitching to you about it, because I was trying to find TV shows, because I read a fair bit of Isaac Asimov and got really like, yeah, I feel like a sci-fi kind of thing, and they're all really like hypersexualized, which I understand because, you know, that's the culture, but to the point where I would feel wildly uncomfortable watching some of these TV shows and would be like, I don't need to see rape that many times. I don't even just need to see naked people that never times. I get it. Like, and it would feel very awkward for that reason, and that always made me nervous about the genre as a whole.
Yeah.
So it's,
if you look at the, like, early trailers for Cyberpunk and the later ones, they are dramatically different. They clearly shifted their marketing approach. They released this trailer really early on, which kind of was a classic. Doesn't really say anything about the game, but just depicts a scene in the world, and that was just to a musical soundtrack. And then obviously later they switched to quite a different kind of storytelling, which is not necessarily wrong, but perhaps positioned it in a way that caused some strife.
Interesting.
Down the track.
Okay. Yeah.
They promised, but they didn't deliver.
Yeah.
At least not initially.
Yeah. Or they just promised something they didn't actually make necessarily, which is another way of looking at it. And that's because I think I enjoy what is there.
Yeah, what was there was actually
Yeah. And I think a lot of the critique has been on what wasn't there. Not many people have perhaps said, okay, well, what is interesting about what they've actually put together at this stage?
Great.
Oh, sounds fascinating. Well, we are at our time limit, I believe. Thank you so much, Heather. Like, it's been a fantastic episode. We've learned so much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for having me.
This is great. We have another perspective. It's nice to
have an excuse
lens.
To waffle about things. Always a good thing.
It is. Well, until next time, goodbye.
See ya.
See ya.